Case number 20-3412, Richard Hale versus Morgan Stanley. Argument not to exceed 15 minutes per side. Mr. Newman, you may proceed for the appellant.
Good morning, and may it please the court. I'd like to begin by giving a brief background of the facts regarding this appeal. Pursuant to Morgan Stanley's mandatory employment arbitration policy, Mr. Hale filed a demand for arbitration with JAMS, challenging three disciplinary actions that the firm had taken against him. After the arbitrator, who was retired federal judge David Corr, issued an award denying Mr. Hale's claims, he filed a motion to vacate the arbitration award pursuant to Section 10 of the Federal Arbitration Act. In response, Morgan Stanley filed a motion to dismiss, arguing that the court had neither federal question jurisdiction or diversity jurisdiction over Mr. Hale's motion to vacate. Mr. Hale submits that the district court erred because, in fact, it had both federal question and diversity jurisdiction over his motion to vacate. So the first issue Mr. Hale's appeal presents to for this court's decision is, did the district court have federal question jurisdiction? And we submit the answer to that is yes.
Between the two, I'll just say selfishly, I was more interested in the diversity jurisdiction question. So could we maybe start with that one?
I'd be happy to do so, Your Honor.
Great. Is there anything, you know, it's this really interesting question of how we factor in the amount and what we look to consider what the amount in controversy is. I'm having trouble finding any textual clues. Is there anything in 18 U.S.C. 1332, in the FAA, is there anything in any of these statutes that would tell us, give us a hint as to what amount we're supposed to look at?
The answer, Judge Rader, is no. And this is a problem because, as we mentioned in the appellant's brief, the majority of employees in this country who work for major companies are required to go through mandatory arbitration. And although the FAA provides grounds for which a employee can base a motion to vacate, there is no textual clues as to the amount that's necessary to satisfy the threshold amount for diversity jurisdiction. So, Your Honor, if I may, let me turn to the second issue.
And, sorry, I didn't mean to throw you off, but
No, Your Honor.
Can I ask, so just to go back over the facts as you covered them, once you want to challenge that arbitration agreement, you have to file a complaint in federal court.
Correct. It's a motion to vacate.
Yeah, is it it's different than what I think of as a traditional complaint?
Pretty much you have to specifically spell out the grounds for the motion to vacate as set forth in Section 10 of the FAA. But the problem is there's a surprise for employees when they do that, because most federal courts say that just bringing a motion to vacate under the Federal Arbitration Act does not by itself establish federal question jurisdiction. You need something independent of that. That's why Mr. Hale is arguing that his independent jurisdiction is that the arbitrator disregarded federal law about the equitable tolling of the statute of the time period to file a discrimination claim in denying his motion to add an age claim. And with regard to diversity, Your Honor, Mr. Hale is arguing that under the general federal rule for establishing the amount in controversy, you look at the complaint. Mr. Hale more than satisfied.
By complaint, you're referring back then to what you also called a motion.
That's correct.
I'm just curious, is the actual title of the document complaint and motion to vacate?
It's just a motion. It's petitioner's motion to vacate. The courts are all
when you, over. When you use the word complaint, you're actually referring to that document.
That's correct, John.
And in that document, you say, I have a claim for $14 million.
That's right. So we Mr. Hale submits that under the general federal rule, he more than satisfied the threshold requirement for diversity jurisdiction because his complaint requested more than $75,000.
Okay, now, so if you mentioned the request in the petition to add an age discrimination claim. So let's say that the court properly, I mean, not the court, the arbitrator properly denied the inclusion or addition of the age claim. Would your client then just be out of luck on the diversity issue?
Well, Your Honor, the answer.
I mean, not just to that claim, but to getting into the federal courthouse door.
Well, I submit the answer is no. Under the general federal rule for determining whether or not a party has satisfied the threshold amount for diversity jurisdiction, courts look to the complaint and what is asked for. So Mr. Hale submits that he gets in under diversity jurisdiction. What Morgan Stanley has done is convince the district court to disregard the general federal rule based on an overbroad reading of this court's decision in Ford versus Hamilton Investments. And we submit that Hamilton Investments does not apply, first of all. The case is distinguishable from Mr. Hale's case because in that case, the plaintiff, Mr. Ford, moved to vacate an arbitration award that fell short of the jurisdictional threshold by almost $20,000. In contrast, Mr. Hale, in his motion to vacate, requested the district court award him an amount that far exceeds the $75,000 threshold. The other thing is there are some compelling reasons why the district court should not have kind of blindly applied Ford. We cited a recent U.S. Supreme Court case drafted by Justice Clarence Thomas that warned courts that you should not blindly follow stare decisis if there are compelling reasons why you should not do so. And we submit in this case, there are three compelling reasons why the district court should not have blindly followed the Ford decision. First of all, under Morgan Stanley's overbroad reading of Ford, it in effect says that the Ford court added to Section 10 of the Federal Arbitration Act the requirement that for a employee to proceed with a motion to vacate, the employee also had to satisfy the more than $75,000 threshold for diversity jurisdiction. We submit that's an absurd result because it would, in effect, render Section 10 of the FAA meaningless for all petitioners like Mr. Hale who lost their arbitration case, but nonetheless have legitimate grounds under the statute to file a motion to vacate. When Congress enacted the Federal Arbitration Act, it never intended to restrict a petitioner's ability to file a motion to vacate in this manner. The second reason is this
You're still talking about Ford, right?
Yes.
Yeah. So we don't have to, do we have to overrule Ford? I mean, isn't...
No. You don't have to.
Like, oh, you talked about stare decisis. So that,
yeah,
that means binding precedent that we don't have to follow or we can ignore. But isn't Ford, wasn't the sort of key to Ford the fact that the amount sought by the plaintiff was $30,000 and that was the same amount as the award? And maybe some courts were confused after that we were looking to the award as opposed to the amount maybe sought by the plaintiff, but it happened to be the same amount in that case. Is that one explanation for what's going on there?
Exactly, Your Honor. But this court, subsequent to Ford, in a decision, Mitchell versus Ann Binder, said that Ford should be interpreted in a limited fashion. Now, if you noticed in the district court's opinion,
can we just interpret how I just described it, or is there something different?
No,
I thought a pretty easy way to explain Ford.
And Your Honor, you're correct. I'm just saying that this court doesn't necessarily have to overrule Ford. They should follow what it did in the Mitchell case and narrowly construe Ford. What the district court—
I don't want to hog all your time. Can I just ask you one other question? If we found for you on one jurisdictional basis, do we have to reach the other one?
No. And I submit, Your Honor, that our first jurisdictional basis, federal question, based on the manifest disregard for federal law, is the winner, and you don't have to address the second question. However, I think it would be helpful for the bar and for employees to have some clarification as to what the Sixth Circuit's current view is with regard to the application of Ford. And with that, based on our arguments, Mr. Hale would respectfully request that this court reverse the district court's decision granting Morgan Stanley's motion to dismiss and remand this case back to the district court for further proceedings consistent with that ruling. Thank you. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Newman. Ms. Gerber?
Yes. Thank you. May it please the court. Tracy Gerber for Appley Morgan Stanley. Judge Radler, I'd like to actually address the issue of the decision of the court in Ford first, although I had not planned to do that since you had asked Mr. Newman about that. In the Ford case at page 260, the court recognized the general federal rule has long been to decide what the amount in controversy is from the complaint itself. And here, the complaint at issue here is the motion to vacate arbitration. That is the operative pleading that Mr. Hale filed in the federal court and which he chose to file in the federal court. So to address—
But in filing that pleading, asking the court to vacate, doesn't that incorporate or refer back to the original complaint? Because otherwise, that's what the whole motion, the whole action was based on.
We disagree that it relates back to the original complaint. And in fact, the motion to vacate here, and I do want to spend a few moments talking about the record that you have before you, the original complaint is actually not even before you. It's not part of the record. It wasn't filed with the motion to vacate. What was filed with the motion to vacate was the final award.
By original complaint, are you referring to the document that initiated the arbitration?
Correct. The document that initiated the arbitration is not part of the record before you. It was not filed with the motion to vacate. What was filed with the motion to vacate was the final award, because that is the document that Mr. Hale is seeking relief from. That is what he is trying to ask the court to vacate. And just to address in Ford the amount in controversy, Judge Radler, I believe that the amount in controversy in the original arbitration was more than the jurisdictional amount at the time. And I'm relying on the following passage. Mr. Ford's complaint alleges that the arbitration panel awarded Hamilton Investments $26,666.63 plus $3,857.53 in interest. The total of these figures obviously does not exceed $50,000. In the arbitration proceeding, Mr. Ford claimed more than $50,000 against Hamilton Investments, but he never asked the district court to order that the arbitrators reopen his claims against Hamilton Investments. All he sought from the district court was the vacation of an award that fell short of the jurisdictional amount by almost $20,000. We have the same situation here.
Yeah, so one dichotomy here is that in one case, the plaintiff won, and in one case, the plaintiff lost. And so this is a case where the plaintiff lost and is appealing. And in that, in the motion that the plaintiff can file, didn't the plaintiff, doesn't Mr. Newman's client refer to his claim for $14 million or whatever it is?
He does. He makes that reference in his motion. Clearly, that's not reflected in the award, and he doesn't attach the operative.
Okay, but setting, I appreciate. Yeah, but shouldn't we use that reference as the equivalent of when you file a complaint in federal court and you seek the amount in controversy and you state the amount in controversy as X? Here be $14 million, and so just like we would under 1332, terming the amount in controversy. Your friend on the other side has put that amount in controversy by including it in the motion?
That's actually not the amount in controversy that Mr. Hale asserted when he filed his original motion to vacate. He filled out the original civil cover sheet in indicating no amount in controversy. And we would...
Okay, so that's a fair point. But setting aside the cover sheet, I mean, the actual document filed in court with the district court that the district court treated as the operative document instituting the litigation, that does reference the $14 million.
It does reference the amount sought in the original arbitration, but again, in this matter, there is no request to reopen the arbitration. There's merely a request to vacate the arbitration award, which we contend was correctly then determined based on Ford's the law set forth in Ford.
I don't mean to hog all the time. I apologize, but what would be the effect of vacating the award? Then his claim would spring back to life for up to $14 million or whatever he sought.
Well, it wouldn't. The court wouldn't have jurisdiction to then all of a sudden award him $14 million. He might have the ability to refile, or the award would just simply be vacated. But here, he did not ask for the relief of remand or the relief of the arbitration proceeding to be reopened. So we don't know what the result would be if the award was vacated by the federal court. Here, it's our position that the federal court didn't have jurisdiction in the first place. And
well, we might not know what the end result would be, but if there was a vacatur, wouldn't the parties automatically be able to go back then and in some forum litigate on the original terms if the arbitration award is vacated? And we may not know the outcome, but isn't that where it puts them?
It is, but that still would not cause the amount in controversy to be $14 million at the federal court level.
But what would they be litigating on unless somebody made some amendment? Because those were the numbers when they started. All of a sudden now it's been vacated, so the slate is back to the beginning.
The slate is back to the beginning, and if an award were rendered in an amount that exceeded the jurisdictional threshold, the parties could find themselves potentially back in federal court on diversity jurisdiction grounds. But here, diversity jurisdiction does not exist on the face of the motion to vacate here, because it is a motion to vacate an award that is zero, because otherwise, then diversity jurisdiction would always exist in any award zero.
Okay, but if we take your logic, doesn't that kind of end up with a nonsensical result, where if all of a sudden the amount is zero and that's the jurisdictional amount, people would not ever be able to look to federal court and. If that's going to be the award, what is there to vacate an appeal if you're now going to be limited to zero?
Well, Judge Donald, parties can still seek to vacate an award if there is federal question jurisdiction, or they can seek to vacate an award in state court. Here, Mr. Hale could have sought relief in state court. That's actually what Morgan Stanley did. Morgan Stanley sought to confirm the award in state court because the federal court did not have jurisdiction on the face of the award, which was zero. And certainly not on the basis of federal question jurisdiction. Applying Ford again, and I do think that this court would have to overrule Ford in order to find diversity jurisdiction here, because Judge Radler, as you mentioned, the amount in controversy in the underlying arbitration at issue in the Ford case actually did exceed the jurisdictional threshold then applicable, because Ford sought relief of more than $50,000. So if
I appreciate you pointing that out. I will definitely go back and look at that, because that was not how I understood it. But I guess the point that sort of got me, and it's not my own thinking, I picked it up from some of the other circuits, was this concern about, you know, suppose Mr. Newman had filed a federal complaint for $14 million. That's a number I keep using. I think it's roughly, but it's clearly more than $75,000. But he files a complaint. You move to remand for arbitration. Arbitration happens. He gets zero, and he wants to come back to federal court and challenge that award. And you say, well, I'm sorry, the award's zero, so there's no federal jurisdiction, when he plainly had federal jurisdiction to start the case. Now, that's not exactly what happened here. We didn't start in federal court. I think we started with the arbitration. But courts have pointed out how odd it would be to have jurisdiction and then no longer have it simply because the party lost the arbitration.
But that is not the record before the court here. Mr. Hale did not start in federal court here. He started by filing a JAMS arbitration.
Right. And I guess he could have, or maybe he could have, I mean, well, because that was maybe because you agree that was the right thing to do, but he theoretically could have come. A lot of times people will question whether the arbitration agreement is valid, and so they'll go to federal court, and then someone will remand, and we'll go back to arbitration. But I don't know. I mean, that dichotomy bothered me, to think that we shouldn't be looking at the amount of the award, but really the amount of the demand. And that's kind of been hung up on, that concern.
Again, I appreciate the questions, but we would contend that under this court's precedent in Ford, which this court should follow its own precedent, that Mr. Hale has not presented a compelling reason to veer from this court's precedent in which set forth in Ford, and that is relying on the amount of the award as the basis for diversity jurisdiction.
Ms. Gerber, if I could just interrupt. You haven't spent much or maybe any time on Mitchell. And Mitchell has been relied on by Mr. Hale for the proposition that, you know, when a petitioner seeks to vacate a $0 arbitration award and reopen arbitration, the amount in controversy includes the amount sought in arbitration, which he says was in excess of $75,000, either $14 million or $350,000 compensatory and $700,000 punitive, but anyways, over $75,000. So how do you distinguish Mitchell, which seemed to work in favor of Mr. Hale here?
Well, the same way that the district court below distinguished it, the court in Mitchell actually relied on Ford in stating that whereas here, the petitioner seeks to reopen the arbitration, the amount in controversy includes the matter at stake in the arbitration. That request was not made here. And that is how the district court distinguished Mitchell. And we contend that this court ought to affirm the district court's appropriate reliance on that distinguishing factor, in that here, Mr. Hale did not seek to reopen the arbitration. And in fact, what he sought was for the court, the district court, to essentially award him the amounts that he was seeking in the underlying arbitration, which the district court surely would not have any legal basis to undertake that question. The issues were squarely decided by Judge Kaur in the arbitration, and Judge Kaur denied the claims that were asserted. I do want to just spend, I see I have very little time left, and I do want to spend just a few moments on the other jurisdictional issue, which we believe there is no federal question jurisdiction here. Mr. Hale has relied on the idea that an assertion of manifest disregard of federal law creates federal question jurisdiction. We contend that that is not the law in the Sixth Circuit, but it certainly cannot be the result here. Because if your honors reference the record and the actual motion to vacate that was filed, there was no contention that Judge Kaur had manifestly disregarded federal law. The issue with regard to federal law and the implication of the ADEA, which in and of itself, reference to the ADEA cannot confer federal question jurisdiction, was that Judge Kaur refused to hear evidence of age discrimination by denying his motion to amend his claim to include an age discrimination claim. That motion to amend is not part of the record, but based on the motion to vacate, your honors can see that the denial of the motion to amend was a timeliness issue based on the application of the CARE arbitration guidelines, which precluded amendments after a period of time. And so there is no federal question that is invoked by the motion to vacate that is on the record before you.
Okay, thanks, Ms. Gerber.
Thank you.
Mr. Newman, you have 3 minutes of rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honors. First of all, let me just address the federal question jurisdiction argument. Manifest disregard has been adopted as a standard for an independent basis for jurisdiction. The Sixth Circuit has adopted in several cases, and the Sixth Circuit in a case, it's the Coffee Beanery case, said that in order to prove manifest disregard, there are two elements. You have to show that there's a clear principle of the law. And second of all, you have to show that the arbitrator disregarded it. That's what Judge Kaur did. Mr. Hale moved for to add an age claim. It was after the time permitted under Morgan Stanley's guidelines for amending. But under the EEOC's manual, that time should have been equitably told. I find it amazing Morgan Stanley has never addressed the application of the EEOC manual in this case. With regard to the procedural arguments that Morgan Stanley has made, it violates, I think, a longstanding principle that courts should decide cases on the merits rather than on procedural technicalities. With regard to the issues Judge Radler raised, yes. There is a concern that once someone files a motion to vacate and they go to federal court and the court has jurisdiction and the party loses, they should, under the Federal Arbitration Act, be able to go back to federal court and have the court take a look at the claims that were raised in the arbitration. The Mitchell case, Judge Cole, is distinguishable. And I submit that the federal court tried to reconcile the clear inconsistency between Ford and Mitchell by focusing on the remedy that the employee sought. I submit that doesn't matter. The remedy should not matter because what you're doing is the courts are restricting a statutory right under the Federal Arbitration Act, and they're trying to add restrictions that do not appear in the statute. That's inappropriate, and that's why the district court's decision needs to be reversed. Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Newman and Ms. Gerber. Appreciate your arguments. I guess we're now into the afternoon. We will take the matter under advisement and have a decision for you in due course.